Welcome to Evidence to Excellence, news in neuroplasticity and rehab powered by the Recovery Project. We want to personally welcome and thank you for joining us today. We're glad that you're here because this podcast is designed to keep you updated on what's new in research and evidence in the neurorehabilitation world. Now, here's your host, Polly Swingle, CEO and co-owner of the Recovery Project.
Welcome, everybody, to the next episode of Evidence to Excellence. My name is Polly Swingle, and I will be your host today. For you guys that are new to our podcast, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I am a physical therapist. I've been a licensed physical therapist for over 35 years, and I am blessed and honored to work at a facility called the Recovery Project. I am also part owner of this company, which was established 20 years ago. So this October, we are celebrating our 20th anniversary at the Recovery Project. So we are very excited about that as well. I have been hosting this podcast for 22 episodes, I think. I think today is our 23rd episode. And it's called Evidence to Excellence. And I'm kind of a geek on science and evidence on what works in rehab, what doesn't work in rehab, some of the new type of programs, equipment, and different types of approaches that we have now to work in the neuro rehab as well as the orthopedic rehab environment. So today we are going to talk about something that is really dear to my heart, and that is rehab management, exercise management, physical therapy management of the older patient, of the older adult. About 7 or 8 years ago, I did sit for the geriatric clinical specialty exam and really just really enhanced my education on the importance of how we dose our older individuals in rehab. So we're going to talk a lot about that today, and I hope you all learn so much in this episode. So let's start by me giving you some statistics that I thought was really interesting on what the population of the aging adult looks like in the United States. So here we go. There are 55.7 million adults over the age of 65. So remember this, you guys, when we talk about geriatrics, that really falls under that age group of 65 and above. This includes 30.8 million women and 24.8 million men. America's older population has grown 38% since 2010, compared to an increase of 2% for the under 65 population. So think about that. If you look at our population, the majority of our population right now is that older adult. And for you guys that kind of follow this stuff, it was really paying attention to and looking at that baby boomer generation, where there were so many children born at that time that the population raised. And now that group of people, which I am in that group, are now aging and 65. Well, I'm not 65 yet, but almost there. But anyways, we are getting into that geriatric range. What else can I tell you? There are about 105,000 people age 100 or older in the United States. This has tripled since 1980. So think about that, right? So we have so many more people that are living and aging in our communities. Among adults over the age of 65 and up, 60% live with their spouse or partner, while roughly 27% live alone. So these individuals, which I think is totally awesome, are living on their own, are in the communities, are participating in our environments, in our world, and also having this excellent quality of life. So it is really important that if something does happen, a fall, if they have surgery, if there's an injury, that from a rehab standpoint, that we can give them evidence, science, the best approach so that they can return back to living on their own and participating in their life. So a couple more statistics. Today's older Americans are healthier overall and living independently for longer. However, most older people have at least one chronic health condition, and many are dealing with multiple health issues. So some of these issues that we're seeing is that people over the age of 65, 47% suffer from arthritis. And then we see those other secondary chronic conditions such as cancer, diabetes, COPD, heart disease, those type of things with this group of individuals. So one of the statistics that I want to talk about that we will dive very, very deep in this is falls. Right now, more than one in four adults over the age of 65 experience a fall each year. And some of those reasons that at least we see in this environment, in this rehab facility of why people fall can be due to changes in eyesight, changes in hearing, definitely a change in their reflexes. Certain comorbidities or a secondary diagnosis such as diabetes, heart disease, thyroid issues, nerve issues can also lead to falls. Conditions that cause, you know, kind of that rush to go to the bathroom because of incontinence or urgency definitely can be a risk for falling. We are also seeing that individuals with mild cognitive deficits tend to fall more than people with severe cognitive deficits. And again, that just kind of makes sense that if somebody has a little bit of a memory issue, that usually those individuals are more mobile. And we do see a higher increase in falling with those type of individuals. So one of the things that we are going to talk about today is that with the aging population, with aging humans, that what we see is a loss in muscle mass. So we're going to talk a lot about that today and how that can be an ongoing problem that can cause falls, but that can also cause death in the long run. So we're going to talk about that and how important it is for the physical therapists out there, for other rehab professionals, that we really need to address this and need to address this based on the science out there. So one of the only other things I want to mention just regarding falls is just real important that the healthcare professionals understand that the medications that our patients are seeing, because sometimes those side effects of those medications can cause falls as well. So that is a lot of information. So let's dive into this topic today. And again, what we're going to talk about is the science and the evidence out there for exercising individuals, rehabbing individuals over the age of 65. So today, I am thrilled to have with me Camden Iwasco, who is a physical therapy assistant. And he has been working at the Recovery Project now for 6 years. And this is and I'm going to call him a young man because he's way younger than me, but this is a young man who is an exceptional clinician. And one of his priorities and values is education. And he has really taken on his own to further his education and keep up with his education on, number one, treating older people, but also in really educating himself on the type of patients that we hear at the that we see at the Recovery Project. Camden also is one of our teachers for other physical therapy assistants that come to our facility for clinical rotations. So he's really a leader here and definitely a very, very smart young man. So Camden, I welcome you to our podcast, and I am so looking forward to talking to you about what you know. And I know that recently you took a very long continuing education course called Modern Management of the Older Adult, and that I think you're going to share some of that evidence with us and then also your other expertise in this area. So let's get into this, Camden, and we're going to start by you telling our audience a little bit about yourself, why you became a PTA, how long you've been here, some of the important education pieces that you have looked into to become the expert that you are. So go ahead, Camden, talk to our audience.
Thanks for having me. My name is Camden. So I started as a PTA in 2017 when I graduated. I started with the Recovery Project just 2 months after I graduated from school. So I've basically been here my whole career. Ever since I began treating here, a majority of my weekly schedule has been that older adult population. You can probably say 80 to 90% is that older adult population. When you see a patient like week after week, you know, month after month, you start to realize what the body is capable of, how much potential each individual has. And it really opens your eyes to like what they can do at an older age. And in my mindset, someone in their 60s or 70s or 80s doesn't seem so old anymore when you start to see their bodies move in the way we see. So it's all exciting stuff. One thing that really kind of hit me hard was the fact that APTA, the American Physical Therapy Association, classified underdosage of the older adult in a therapy setting is a top five issue in the United States, and it's being classified as a professional pandemic. So I basically want to be a part of that change in avoiding underdosage.
And I can't wait to hear how we're really going to address that, because I agree with you. I mean, as I was saying, I've been in this profession for such a long time, and I think it was always the thought that if you have a very frail or sick individual patient come to you and you're like, okay, we need to build up your strength, we need to get you walking, your aerobic endurance, your cardiovascular endurance, that sometimes it's like, wow, how hard can I push them? So I know we're going to talk about that. But before we get there, I want you to describe, you know, the physiological process or changes that help, that happen as we age. And there's a thing called the geriatric syndromes, frailty. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and what you know about that?
Yeah, I'll get into the like frailty, sarcopenia, all those types of things in a little bit. I wanted to start off by just describing what's happening anatomically as someone ages naturally. It's all a part of aging. It's going to happen. So I want to be a little bit more in depth with this because I believe it is important to understand what is happening in the body as we age, and then we can really bring it like to our attention as clinicians in avoiding underdosing that older population. So as an individual ages, there are physiological changes that our body experiences. These include accumulation of low-grade inflammation, accumulation of oxidative stress, an increase in cellular senescence, which is like the apoptosis of the cells happening at a faster rate than regeneration. Stem cell exhaustion, so those cells the body uses that are used to create resiliency, and then mitochondrial dysfunction. So in our cardiac system, as we age, we have an increase in arterial stiffness, decrease in max heart rate, a decrease in stroke volume, a decrease in cardiac output, and an increase in the weight and size of our heart. This causes an increased risk of congestive heart failure, atherosclerosis, and hypertension, which you see pretty commonly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In our pulmonary system, we have an increase in chest stiffness as we age, a decrease in alveoli, and an increase in our residual volume in the lung, as well as a decrease in the tidal volume in the lung, which is basically how much of a breath you can take. Mm-hmm. This causes risk in COPD, emphysema, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, as well as pneumonia. In our neurological system, we see a shrinking in our gray and white matter. We have a loss of synaptic density, which is the connections between neurons. They're more affected as we get older. A decrease in our long-term potentiation, so building those long-term habits of memory, basically. Once you do something once or twice, it starts to build it into that long-term memory where you can just kind of automatically produce a movement or function. A decline in the executive function and reaction time, which affects our balance, and increasing our processing time. All of these things are an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and then as well as neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's, as well as like risk of increased like strokes, things like that.
You know, that sounds so depressing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and I was listening to this other podcast recently, and you know, I'm turning 60 very, very soon. And one of the things they said are, what are the five things that you're supposed to pay attention to when you're turning 60? And one of those, and I won't get into this, that's a whole nother story, but one of those is your health. And I think exactly what you said that triggered in my mind is like all of these things are physiologically happening to us. We can't take a pill and reverse the aging process.
Right.
I do think there are things that I know we're going to talk about that we can do, lifestyle changes through exercise and different things that we can slow down that aging process.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of those things, many of those things that changes, we can either slow it down, stop it, and also if you've already seen some of those changes, possibly get back some of that aerobic function or strength or so on and so forth.
Absolutely.
So audience, what we're saying is, yes, that sounds like, oh my gosh, that's so doom and gloom, but there are definitely things that we can do to slow it down. And how important that is, that the sooner that you work on those things, is that as we get into our 60s, our 70s, 80s, 90s, and maybe even 100, I think the most important thing is that we maintain our function and you have a quality of life.
Right.
Yep, exactly. Okay. So there are beliefs, expectations, stereotypes of aging and the impact on older lives. Do you want to share a little bit about what we see, you know, in our communities, how people think about the aging population?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that stood out to me is there's a lot of, you know, nothing against family members or spouses, but as, let's say, somebody's grandparent is getting into that older age and they're becoming more of a fall risk, they're fed a lot of comments like, I don't want you going to the grocery store anymore. I don't want you walking to the mailbox down the, you know, the inclined driveway. And this starts to put fear into these people's minds. And the second fear increases, fall risk increases.
Absolutely.
And there's a big correlation with fall risk and just lack of confidence. So once people are starting to be fed that type of negative mindset, it can kind of take a downward swing or a downward spiral, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's even that, I shouldn't say this, but even like my mother, who's 85 right now, it's almost like, well, she used to be a swimmer. And I would be like, well, maybe you shouldn't be swimming all of those laps. And I know better, but really saying that to her really is the opposite of what we should be saying, because
right.
we want you to challenge yourself. Yes, we'll give you suggestions to do it safer, but we also want you to exercise and be active and do all those
kind
of things.
And it's easy for someone to be like looking out for the best of them. You know, they don't
Absolutely.
Want them to fall or get injured. But with that being said, there's two types of ageism. There's positive ageism and negative ageism. Negative ageism is what we just said, where you're feeding these negative mindsets, negative comments, producing fear in the individual. Positive ageism is someone that might be excited about the process of getting older. Maybe they have more wealth at that point. Maybe they're, let's say when someone feels excited about being more wise, or they have more knowledge than your younger population, things like that. One statistic that was pretty wild was that when an individual has a positive ageism and mindset versus a negative ageism mindset, they live on average 7.5 years longer than the
Wow.
ones with negative mindsets. So immediately we need to start flipping that mindset, stop putting fear into individuals. Another statistic is that positive age stereotypes are 44% more likely to fully recover from a disability.
I believe that because I've seen that.
Yeah.
100%. Yes.
And then positive ageist stereotypes were 50% less likely to develop dementia as well. So just by being positive, right? Got to bring positivity into the world.
So as a clinician, that's important, I would think, for you and how you treat your patients. And that's probably why all your patients love you so much as well, is that giving them that, okay, we got this.
Yeah.
You can do this.
You feed them that confidence and that education of why we're doing what we're going to be doing to prevent all these things. Not to scare the individual that this is going to be something they deal with, but just to give them that confidence and that trust in me to help them get there or prevent these things from happening.
I love that. I love that. So let's talk a little bit about an exercise program, because I know we're going to dive pretty deep into this. And we'll talk about physical therapy. You have a patient coming into physical therapy and you're going to start an exercise program. What are some of the misconceptions or the myths that some of our peers out there have if they don't follow the evidence and aren't educated on the way that maybe they design an exercise program or a plan of care?
Yeah, I mean, some of the myths, like we've talked about, is someone that's coming in looking frail and weak and have, you know, decreased muscle mass. Some people can get in the mindset of like they don't want to hurt them or do an exercise that might make them in more pain or, you know, those types of things. But you got to think of like the risk of challenging someone with these higher intensity exercises we will get to and talk about. You got to think the opposite end, like the risk of not pushing these patients.
Yeah.
If we don't push these patients, we're setting them at risk, setting them up for risk of all the things I just listed that happen
right.
in the natural process of aging.
Right. So what is the science and evidence showing now of how we are supposed to exercise the aging adult?
So we need to increase intensities and loads. We have to start loading these individuals, getting their feet planted into the ground and start performing more squats, more, you call them closed chain exercises, right? And these multi-joint lifts and exercises, basically. We as providers need these exercises to actually benefit the body and prevent that aging process of all those different risks that we just mentioned. We're basically promoting physical activity. The less we have someone in that sedentary state where they're sitting around all day and just getting weaker day by day, we need to just promote that physical activity and educate them and empower them to start getting up and doing more.
So give me an example of, you can tell the audience the certain kind of patient you're thinking of how you would design a program or dose them and progress them.
Yeah. So no matter what or what level the individual is at, we need a more fitness forward approach. We need to start getting people moving. Our goals with exercise prescription in a fitness forward approach is two things: reducing that sedentary behavior and increasing physical activity. In the home setting, it can be simply like getting off the couch or performing that max assist transfer and getting them to start putting weight if they're laying in bed all day or they can't ambulate or walk around. There's a three-part framework when trying to get people moving and prescribing these exercises. The first part is making it meaningful. We have to try to correlate our exercises to goals or what they're having difficulties with, whether it's picking up a dog, you know, holding their dog in their lap. If that dog weighs 10 pounds and they're just sitting in bed, it's going to be challenging for them to bend down and pick that dog up. It's basically, are we practicing burpees or floor transfers if someone's wanting to get under the table and sweep or something like that, right? All those purposeful exercises. Are we practicing squats if, you know, they need to fill up the dog bowl or feed their dog? You know what I mean? The second part of that is load it. So loading individuals. Higher intensity exercises or higher resistive exercises. Higher intensity resistance training is highly effective for preventative strategies such as sarcopenia, you know, muscle weakness. If someone is walking into the clinic and capable of deadlifting 150 pounds, why are we laying them on a mat and doing the ball squeezes, the adductor squeezes, the short arc quads versus a yellow band? Like, what are we really doing for them?
Now, I was just going to say that that is exactly where my mind went, where even, I mean, I've done home care, but home care or outpatient, that you walk through the clinic and people are on a mat, or a patient will come to you and said, oh, I did physical therapy 6 months ago. And then we say, well, tell me a little bit about the program that you did. And they said, well, they put a yellow band around my knees and I did this, or a bolster under my knees. And for a half an hour, I did exercise on the mat. And then I was on the new step for 15 minutes. And then they stretched me.
Yeah. And you might still see it, right? You walk into a clinic, you might still see it happening in front of your eyes. So this is the purpose of this course, was to really shift our mindsets as our company, as, you know, the whole United States, of getting away from this underdosage.
But, and I also love the idea how you said, you got to get them on their feet. Like, you have to get your patient weight bearing through their feet. So even somebody that maybe spends most of their day in bed, that as a therapist going in there and saying, we're going to sit you up on the end of the bed, you're going to feel your feet into the ground, and we're going to work on, maybe it's just lifting your butt off the bed and sitting back down, but that partial sit to stand or full sit to stand, but, you know, something where they're definitely weight bearing through their legs.
Right. Yeah. And there are times that some of these lower level exercises are appropriate, based on other conditions. But yeah, we need to start challenging ourselves as clinicians. You know, there's one rep max calculators out there. There's AMRAPs, which is as many reps as possible. Like, if you're having trouble, you know, prescribing an exercise based on deadlifts and squats, you know, all the stuff we're going to get to, start doing as many reps as possible. If they're ripping out 25, 30 body weight squats, then we got to start upping weight and other ways to make it harder.
Right. It's that intensity.
Yeah.
Intensity matters. So we've been talking about exercises. So let's go a little deeper into these multiple joint exercises. If you can talk a little bit about that, why the evidence is showing the importance of adding those to your plan of care, to your session when you're working with somebody. If it was somebody with just mobility issues, somebody with arthritis, somebody that maybe had an episode or an exacerbation of their COPD, and now they're coming to you because they just have been sedentary for a period of time.
Yeah.
COVID's a great example that they haven't been doing much. Then all of a sudden they come onto your schedule and they have lost so much muscle mass, so much function. But talk about those multi-joint exercises. Give some examples of what they are, maybe how to do them and why they're important.
Yeah. So as people age, it's important that we start, you know, putting their feet through the floor and start picking up and setting down weight. With all the, you know, risks of aging and all that that I already listed, our bones also become more fragile, right? So you might have heard the term osteopenia or osteoporosis, which is very common in our older population. Loading our joints will help reduce this risk and even reverse these symptoms as we age. We are starting to learn that more of this high-intensity resistance and higher impact training improves bone mineral density and physical function in specifically like post-menopause. Yeah. So we know that as a female ages, you know, you start to hit menopause. After that, your bone density becomes weakened and more vulnerable. So all these exercises like deadlifts, squats, loaded carries, which means like holding a weight in your hand and walking around, like adding weight to your body with movement, like that are all, those are all examples of higher intensity lifts and exercises that's going to prevent those osteoporosis, osteopenia, all that from happening. There's some variations. Like if someone doesn't have like the grip strength to hold a weight, you know, we have weighted vests you can put on their trunk. You can even just adding some ankle weights to their legs, making them walk around. You can even mimic a purse by putting a plate weight around a gait belt and putting it over their shoulder. You know, a lot of people wear those satchels or whatever they're called nowadays.
Fanny packs,
right?
That we
fanny
strap
packs
around us. Yep.
So basically, making it harder in the clinic is going to carry over to their everyday life and improve their function, right? So deadlifts are key in this. It's a big posterior chain exercise, right? Your legs, your back, your core, just holding that weight is going to improve grip strength. Talking about grip strength triggered a thought. One thing that really stuck out to me in this course that I saw was decreased grip strength increases your risk of like congestive heart failure and all those types of things dramatically. So just by holding these weights, getting people to do squats and deadlifts and holding weight is improving grip strength without you even really thinking about it.
Yep.
So there's a lot of purpose behind what we're doing and not just telling people like, all right, we're getting back into the powerlifting.
Right.
We can elevate the surface a little bit if someone has back pain, right? Bring the weight up to them a little so you're reducing their range of motion and their stress on their back. Performing more of like a front squat is going to prevent more lumbar pain. You know, it's going to prevent them from bending so far forward into that squat motion. So there's a lot of ways that we can modify or adapt to match an individual's needs.
So, and I wasn't going to ask this question yet, but I'm going to because this is where my brain is going. You've been using this approach for quite some time with all of your patients. And many of our patients, as we talked about before, have this fear.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's fear of falling. Maybe it's fear of working too hard and then their arthritic pain flares up. And then in the past, oh my gosh, I don't want to hurt because then I can't do this. I can't feed my dog. I can't do this. So with your experience and your, you know, now adding these weights, adding these so much bigger movements, very, very different than, as we said previously, a TheraBand and doing like a short arc quad. How do you address that fear with your patient? Give some examples of maybe how you educated your patient and pushed them through and had them do this type of exercising and the outcomes that they had.
Yeah. So again, back to education, right? Teaching your patient that improving your strength and power of these exercises is going to improve like reaction strategies, right? The stronger an individual is, the more like that type 2 muscle fibers that are decreased in aging.
Yep.
That's going to improve their abilities to step and react to a loss of balance, right? We're preventing falls. We're not just trying to create bodybuilders here, right?
Yes.
Fall prevention, right? So if we're increasing the type 2 fibers and that reaction strategies, then as people are moving around and maybe they step on a stick outside and they causes a loss of balance, then they're going to be able to react quicker. getting into that, I mean, balance training is key as well. So maybe part of the session is focused around these higher intensity lifts. And as someone fatigues, maybe we start to add more balance into the equation and more dynamic balance. They made a comment in that course I took about how the tandem stance is the ankle pump of balance training. Like, the most falls occur with dual tasking or doing two things at once. So figuring out what we need to provide the patient with our balance training, like having them count backwards by sevens from 100 while they're performing other tasks, challenging their balance. Floor transfers is a key part in prescribing these exercises as well, because the more familiar they get with the floor, it doesn't feel so far away when maybe a fall does happen or they develop strategies to reduce, you know, injury or fractures.
Is that something you regularly do with all of your patients?
Trying to increase that. Yeah. I think floor transfers by itself is a fearful term for a patient.
Yeah.
And even as a clinician, it's like, okay, this might be really hard to get through a floor transfer with them, so maybe I avoid it for the next week. But the sooner you attack this, the better off you're making your patient.
Yeah, right? No, so. And I've always believed that as well, is that it's so important that people are comfortable, excuse me, getting down on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But also being able to get back up, because there is that fear, you know, always like, well, what happens if I fall and I'm alone?
Right.
Then
right.
What? Right. So, yeah, I agree with that. And I like hearing that. And I think that's a great message for clinicians or even people that are older listening to this podcast, how important it is that if you're afraid to do that on your own, go into physical therapy and work on that one functional activity with your physical therapist, because you also have to have lower body strength.
Right.
To get off the floor.
To pop up.
And core. All that stuff that you talked about working on. Let me ask you about, since we're talking about aging, that unfortunately sometimes you may work with people that have a cognitive deficit. So if you're treating somebody, assessing somebody, and this approach of using this science and evidence with everything we've talked about, but they have a mild or a moderate cognitive deficit, how does that change your approach?
It maybe just adds some like alertness on my end, right? So there's other scales that we can do, subjective measures like the PSFS, the patient-specific functional scale, the ABC scale, the activity-specific balance confidence, as well as a falls efficacy scale. That'll give us a little more insight on the patient's current levels of capabilities or fear and confidence with certain tasks. If you're adding a little cognitive component into the equation, maybe if there's like impulsivity or like someone's a little more impulsive, being conscious of like guarding the weight, right? So making sure that if they're holding weight, walking around or doing a deadlift, maybe you're right there with them holding that bar or holding the dumbbell in their hand and giving them a little more security. So I'm not afraid they're going to drop it and all of a sudden break their foot from the dumbbell.
Right. Right.
So I'll maybe grip assists, right? In the neurological setting that we're in, we see a lot of people with impaired hand function. So maybe strapping a grip assist on their hand, holding the weight. I currently have a couple people that might just spontaneously throw a cane to the side or something. So if I'm really trying to benefit them with this type of strategy, grip assist might prevent them from being able to harm themselves or myself.
Right. I know there is a lot of evidence out there when we look at Parkinson's disease, stroke, of the importance of aerobic activity, you know, and increasing that heart rate and increasing blood flow and bathing of the brain. And that kind of made me go here with people with maybe mild cognitive deficits, of that importance of even working aerobically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you add that to part of your program for the aging adult?
Yeah, absolutely. It correlates just with all the other research out there that you've had podcasts in the past about,
yeah,
like Parkinson's and all those neurological conditions like stroke, about high intensity gait training. It all correlates exactly with what we're talking about. Now, if someone's coming in for general weakness or like balance issues, then we're kind of applying the same principles with them as we would be with our higher intensity, except just a little bit different of a mindset, you know, not just focusing on freezing or stiffness, rigidity like Parkinson's, but we're just developing better balance strategies and strength, becoming more resilient to falls.
So I want you to give our audience a recommendation, a summary, because what we talked about is dosage. And as you said, I believe you, and I agree with you that I think our profession at this point in time where we're at, we are underdosing.
Mm-hmm.
So give our audience the recommendation or a summary of what is the proper dosing. So if you would break it down, how many times a week should a patient be seen, maybe in skilled PT if they need PT? You know, dosing would be, what is your resistance, aerobic, balance, whatever. How would you answer that question?
Yeah, so it kind of, with prescribing the right amount of dosage, we've talked about like the one rep max calculators, the as many reps as possible technique. Right. If, like I said earlier, if we're doing 25 reps and they're, you know, they're still talking about the news, then we know they're not working hard enough.
Yep.
Right. So it kind of correlates with all of that. I kind of forgot that first part of that question.
No. So I was just going to say, so I'll break it down for you. Dosage. What do you feel is the appropriate frequency if somebody's in skilled PT?
Okay. So I always describe it as like, let's just say a bodybuilder, right? We're talking about these higher lifts and more intense exercises. If a bodybuilder is only working out 2 days a week, like someone is on schedule in therapy 2 days a week for that 1 hour session, are you really going to get any stronger? Probably not. So educating them, like, you need to be doing 5-6 days a week of some moderate to high intensity exercise. And maybe I'll show them safe ways to do it at home.
Perfect.
And we can do the harder, more in-depth lifts in the clinic. You know, not everyone has like a squat bar or barbell or dumbbell. So maybe we just educate them on as many reps as possible techniques, maybe sit to stands with holding a weight or things like that. If they're doing the 2 hours a week, that's well below what we need to be doing.
So would you say, or is it safe to say that with the older adult, resistive training is a key element to be in almost every single plan of care?
Absolutely.
And aerobic training, is it an element that must be in?
Yes, I'd say so.
Okay. Yeah. And then for the older adult, probably balance training is what I'm hearing you say.
Higher resistive intensity strengthening, that aerobic high intensity gait training, getting their heart rates well above their resting heart rate and nourishing that brain, as well as the balance training.
And I think we've said this in so many other talks where I've talked to so many other experts that the importance of, and I think we lack this in our profession, is that not using the RP scale like they should, mm-hmm. or not really checking their heart rate. Because how do you know somebody is working at that moderate intensity or that intensity that you need them to if you don't check it?
Right.
And nowadays, you know, so many of us have the watches that can check our heart rate, or they're on your phone, and even our older individuals now have this technology to educate them, like, I want you to look and see what your heart rate is while you're doing your exercises at home, because I want it to elevate. I don't want it to be the same.
Yeah. And I'm based on my caseload, probably 50% of the older population are starting to have that technology, and there is still a lot that don't, right? So educating them on the RPE scale, I get print-offs to take home so they can put it by their bike or something. You know, and if we're at that 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10, that's where we want to be. If, you know, they're having a full conversation or saying 2 to 3 sentences before they're losing breath, we're probably not pushing it enough. So I explain that from day one. And then every single session they're in here, I'm reminding them.
Perfect.
And they're catching on. And then we're seeing better stuff.
Are you seeing better outcomes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. 100%. That is the bottom line. Better outcomes, better quality of life, less falls. Because what we don't want to happen is somebody that's older fall, and then you break a hip, you hit your head, so many other bad things can happen.
And my favorite part is seeing how much happier they are from day one to 4 weeks later. Just in that first month, they're having conversations with other people in the clinic, or they're more outgoing and happier and cheerful. And
so I'm going to invite you back because we're going to have a part two of this. So one of the things that I know that you are in the process of studying and getting even more education and evidence on very specific diagnoses in, you know, the management in this approach of, we need to change the dosage. Mm-hmm. We've had many, many podcasts where we've talked about stroke and Parkinson's disease, and here is the clinical practice guidelines. But what we talked about today is really this, and I'm going to say it's a clinical practice guideline, but all of these elements need to be incorporated with even those specific diagnoses that we see here. Again, yeah, MS,
right?
PD, stroke, fractures, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we will definitely have you back. Is there anything that you want to add to this that I didn't ask you?
No, I just want to kind of challenge every clinician out there to take this on and try to increase your intensities in your sessions. I mean, the MMOA, Modern Management of the Older Adult, the course I took through them was just incredible. Like, it already shifted my mindset dramatically with where I need to challenge my patients. So as you said, the part two, which I'm super excited for, I'm enrolling in the course this fall, but it is specific concepts to people living with Parkinson's, MS, strokes, arthritis, osteoporosis, urinary incontinence, cardiac and cardiopulmonary rehab, as well as like a master athlete. So for part two, I'll be able to go in depth with all of those diagnoses awesome. That we see every day here at the Recovery Project.
Well, I love that you sent that challenge out to everybody to really, you know, the clinicians out there and the patients to talk to their clinicians, their therapists to say, I want you to work me harder. So I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank
this
you
was
for having
great.
Me.
You are welcome. And audience, I want you to always remind you that our website here at The Recovery Project is www.therecoveryproject.net. If you have any information on any of our programs, we have a ton of education on the website. Please check us out. Also following us on our social channels, Instagram and Facebook. And if you ever have any questions specifically for me or for any of our clinicians here, you can always ask on the website as well. So again, I want to thank you, Camden, and everybody. You enjoy the rest of your summer, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to today's Evidence to Excellence News in Neuroplasticity and Rehab podcast. We appreciate you and hope that you come back every fourth Tuesday of the month to get more of what's new in evidence and research in the neurorehabilitation world. To learn more about the Recovery Project or to find out what we're up to next, you can visit us anytime at therecoveryproject.net.